rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border. Our quote for the day by Abraham Lincoln: the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Coming up on today's program, David Bacon will be here from the Pacific News Service in the second hour of our program on labor, immigration, the impact of the global economy on workers. And in the third hour, Harry Taylor will be here, the fellow who stood up and told George Bush he should be ashamed of himself. And in the third hour of our program, we will hear from Harry Taylor and his take on George W. Bush and just, you know, that whole sort of thing there. Today is the 65th anniversary of the death of Franklin Roosevelt. FDR died on this day in Warm Springs, Arkansas, back in 1945. And so throughout the day, throughout the program, we're going to play a few clips here and there of FDR. Here is one on FDR on just the problems that we were confronting as he came into office and how he sees America now as a consequence of that.
I see a great nation upon a great continent blessed with a great wealth of national resources. Its 130 million people are at peace among themselves. They are making their country a good neighbor among the nations. I see a United States which can demonstrate that under democratic methods of government, national wealth can be translated into a spreading volume of human comfort hitherto unknown.
By the way, when he speaks about being a good neighbor, he had this good neighbor policy with the rest of Latin America, basically repudiating the McKinley policy of, you know, let's start a war here wherever we can.
And the lowest standard of living can be raised far above the level of mere subsistence.
So this is the upside that he sees in America. And then he looks out. Keep in mind, this was 1937. This was March 4th, 1937, his second inaugural address.
But here is the challenge to our democracy. In this nation, I see tens of millions of its citizens, a substantial part of its whole population, who at this very moment are denied the greater part of what the very lowest standards of today call the necessities of life. I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished. The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little.
And then Roosevelt said,
if I know aught of the spirit and purpose of our nation, we will not listen to comfort, opportunism, and timidity. We will carry on.
We will not listen to comfort, opportunism, and timidity. There you go. Well said. We have with us today David Tebow. He's the editor-in-chief of Cybercast News Service, cnsnews.com, a conservative news service on the Internet, cnsnews.com. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
The California PTA has recently come out with a, news release, I guess it is?
Yeah.
Yeah, in which they say that, I have it in front of me, in fact, and you wrote an op-ed piece about it or an article about it, in which they suggest that that all children in California should be entitled to an education that teaches them to be good citizens, and that it's in the interests of society and the families for this to happen, and that both parents and schools should be involved in that. You take exception to that. How?
Well, I don't take exception to it in terms of any kind of commentary, because what we did, Tom, was we wrote a news article about that press release, but in conjunction with the California State PTA's views on illegal immigration. The incoherence, according to one of the critics, lies in the fact that the PTA is supporting illegal immigrants in this country, while at the same time maintaining that parents of the very people who broke the law by entering the United States ought to be the ones who tell their children to obey the law. And there is a fundamental incoherence or inconsistency in that, according to the critics of the PTA.
There's a disconnect in the latter there, and I don't disagree with that disconnect, but you say the PTA is supporting illegal immigrants in California. Isn't there a certain level where we should say things like, you know, housing, education, and medical services, and food, for example, are you know, the basic necessities of human life, and mm-hmm. to deprive somebody of that, even if they have illegal immigrant status, to deprive something of that is less than, at the very least, less than Christian or Jewish of us, less than I would think American of us.
Well, certainly that's the moral issue that a lot of people view the problem of illegal immigration, Tom, but at the same time, do you want to just open up our borders to anybody who wants to come across those borders without any questions asked?
No, I don't. And David, I think you know my position on this. I'm very strongly opposed to illegal immigration to the United States. I think every nation has an obligation to define its boundaries, just like every cell has a membrane. You know, there's a reason for national borders. And a lot of that reason has to do with the quality of life that people want to have. And a function of that quality of life, or a piece of that quality of life, is wages that are paid, and wages, as David Ricardo pointed out in 1813, is a function of the size of the labor pool versus the demand for labor. And so you flood the labor pool, you drive down the cost of labor.
We can't transfer our principles to Mexico or any other country.
No, we can't. And I'm agreeing with you on that. You know, I think we disagree on probably how it should be done. I think that I don't think that criminalizing people or putting people in buses and trying to ship them down to Mexico or building fences are going to do any good any more than that kind of effort has stopped the flow of drugs. I think that what you do is you stop the demand for it. And while we'll probably never succeed in stopping people wanting to buy drugs in the United States, we can stop employers from hiring illegal aliens.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all, Tom. I think that that's a very wise approach. I mean, there are a lot of different approaches that have been mentioned over the last several days.
But there's no Republicans talking about this. There's no Democrats talking about this, for that matter. I mean, you know, let's criminalize the employers. Everybody's afraid of taking on the corporations.
I think you're absolutely right on that, Tom. I think
so. Where are your colleagues?
Well, Republicans do not. I have no loyalty to the Republicans or the Democrats on this issue. The Republicans are not courageous in terms of what you just described. The Democrats are not courageous because they see the illegal immigrants as future voters for Democrats.
Yeah, and the Republicans see them as future cheap labor for their corporate
right.
donors. It's
absolutely.
Like we've got two groups who are pandering to folks, and in the meanwhile, the working class of America be damned.
But more germane to the story that we're talking about here, Tom, how do you support the kind of liberal views of illegal immigration and then turn around and tell the parents who entered illegally that they should tell their children about obeying the law? I mean,
but I read this news release, and I've spent
have.
Some time looking around the California State PTA's website, and I don't see anywhere on there where they say that they're doing what you say they're doing, which is advocating on behalf of illegal immigration.
PTA,
I don't see that anywhere.
The PTAs around the country, Tom, are liberal organizations. They're very closely connected to the unions, and as such, they support the liberal view.
There are some unions that are very strongly opposed to illegal immigration, and there's a lot of liberals who are opposed to illegal immigration.
But you know, for the most part, that unions see illegal immigration as bolstering their troops. Eventually, I mean,
David Tebow, CNS News, .com. I agree with you that tragically, since 2000, the AFL-CIO and several other unions have taken the position that, hey, these are potential members down the road.
Right.
And maybe they are. Maybe it'll work out that way. I just think it's wrong. But I still don't see where the California State PTA specifically is saying anything that could be closely construed in any way as supporting illegal immigration. All they're saying is let's educate all the children in this state. And that just seems like, you know, common sense and human decency.
Well, it is common sense and human decency for anybody who is here legally. But again, do you want to judge the illegal entry?
Should the children be paying for the sins of their parents? I mean, do you want to have a citizenship requirement for the kids?
I want the parents to have the responsibility for having broken the law in the first place.
I agree with you, but does that mean that you say to the child, sorry, you can't come into this school?
I think that if you say to the parent, sorry, you can't work,
that the parent will say, okay, I'm not going to stay here, and they'll go back home to Mexico.
I think you have to deport the people who are here illegally.
Well, you know, it sounds nice. I suspect, though, that if they just don't have jobs anymore, that most of them will leave. And then, you know,
I can't disagree with that, Tom.
Yeah, okay. David Thiebold, CNSNews.com. Good talking to you, David.
All right, sir.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program, and you know strange things are in the air when conservatives and liberals are agreeing. Good grief.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Democracy Now!
Welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Speaking of immigrants, foreign immigrants, we have a Canada goose on our back deck. This guy, he flew down from Canada. I don't know, maybe he started out in Alaska. Maybe he's an Alaskan goose, and so I shouldn't pick on him. I think he's a Canadian goose, and he's sitting on our back deck. And when we walk, we live in a house that is floating in the Willamette River. There's, you know, these houses that there's giant poles that go down into the bottom of the river, and there's a dock, a long deck, and then the house is anchored to the deck. So it's a floating house. It's not a houseboat. It doesn't have power or anything. It's just, you know, anyhow, this goose has set up residence and so our backyard is a deck that floats behind our house. And this goose is sitting out there, and whenever we walk out, he's like, quack, 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 quack. And there's another one around the corner, and it turns out that their partners have laid eggs nearby. Our next-door neighbor has let a female goose lay, I guess she's up to 5 eggs now, on her back deck. She's built a little nest, and this is her husband, I guess, the male goose, the male of the pair. They're monogamous. And he's on the back deck honking and yelling whenever anybody gets near his wife. So we've Goosellini is what we named him last year. I think it's a different goose this year, but he's got the same attitude. So it's Goosellini. Anyhow, that's interesting. You know, maybe we'll become grandparents. This is. I got an email here from a fellow by the name of Jeff, who this is an interesting take or consideration that I hadn't thought of before. He said, I had a chance to talk to this man the other day. He was around 70. He said, we talked about immigration and the immigrants who came from Europe. And he told me some things that I already knew but hadn't connected the dots on, as well as things I didn't know. He said, a lot of immigrants came here to Europe to escape the wars that were going on there. He told how young men would be pressed into service. This is called impress, actually back in the 18th century. As a result of that practice, at one time in our history, when children came over from Europe, they were immediately granted U.S. citizenship so that they would not be, you know, captured and forced into armies. He says, I started wondering about the time frame when the immigrants from Europe came over. If it were right now, then they would have been considered refugees. It seems that the immigrants were more concerned about coming to the U.S. to avoid war than because of opportunity. And you look back, and yeah, the massive influx of Irish, for example, over 1 million Irish came to the United States, but another 1 million Irish died during the potato famine of starvation. These were refugees. You could argue that the same is true of many of these large waves of immigration. The British actually were using the state of Georgia as a penal colony through much of the 1700s. So they were deporting people to the United States. And he says, it seemed that the immigrants would be more concerned about coming to the U.S. to avoid war than because of opportunity. It seems like the spin was put on the immigration of people from Europe by the robber barons who needed a workforce to build railroads who would be willing to accept peanuts for wages. He says, maybe I'm wrong about that, but I wonder how many immigrants came from Europe, or for that case from Asia, to avoid war and ended up being exploited by the railroads. I wonder how many men in Europe or in Asia were concerned enough about their sons that they would quit their jobs, give up their homes, and come to the U.S. to keep their sons from being pressed into service. He said, there's more I could get into this, but I know you have a lot of email, and thank you for reading this. Yeah. Jeff, thanks for the email. It's interesting, interesting point, interesting concept. Franklin Roosevelt, by the way, as I mentioned, it's the 65th anniversary of his death, if I'm doing my math right. And he, on this day, and in 1941, in May 27th, 1941, the United States had not yet entered the war. We didn't enter the war until December 7th, as I recall, of 1941. And so Roosevelt was making it very clear that Germany was the enemy. And every time he'd give these speeches, the Republicans would go nuts. They would go ballistic, criticizing him and calling him a warmonger and this, that, and the other thing. But here, for example, he talks about in this speech, this is one of his fireside chats from May 27th, 1941. He talks about how the Nazis are on their way. And they want the Americas as well as Europe, and they have very specific plans for our workers.
The American laborer would have to compete with slave labor in the rest of the world. Minimum wages, maximum hours, nonsense.
In other words, Hitler would say, what, you on minimum wage laws? You can't have that. What, maximum hour laws, 40-hour week? You can't have that. Nonsense. That would be Hitler's position. This is the point that Roosevelt is making here. This he's talking about fascism, the merging of corporate and state interests, the Nazi fascism.
Wages and hours fixed by Hitler. The dignity and power and standard of living of the American worker and farmer would be gone. Trade unions would become historic relics and collective bargaining a joke. Farm income... What happens to all farm surpluses without any foreign trade?
And then he goes on from there talking about how this entire thing would be a disaster if it was all run of, by, and for the Nazi nation state and the fascists. And, do away with trade unions. Do away with minimum wage laws. Do away with maximum number of hours a week you can work laws. Yeah, that's what we would get if we got Hitler, says Franklin Roosevelt. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by revitalizing democracy in the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. Our number 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you right in there. On May 29th, 2003, this just a few weeks after George W. Bush's initial proclamation, you'll recall Bush, I believe it was May 1st of 2003, said...
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
So, you know, he comes out and he says, okay, we've won the war. And then on the 29th, so we're about three, 4 weeks later, Ari Fleischer comes out and says, and by the way, those weapons of mass destruction? Well, actually, here's the setup with Helen Thomas asking the question and then Ari Fleischer's response.
Is the president satisfied with the intelligence he got before the war? Because now one cabinet officer is saying that they buried the weapons, another says they destroyed them, and another official says they... What is the president's view on all that?
The president is indeed satisfied with the intelligence that he received, and I think that's borne out by the fact that, just as Secretary Powell described to the United Nations, we have found the bio trucks that can be used only for the purpose of producing biological weapons.
Whoa! Ari Fleischer, yes, we found the weapons of mass destruction. And, in fact, a soundbite that played over and over and over on Fox News so long that probably people who watch Fox News regularly can still repeat it from memory.
That's proof perfect that the intelligence in that regard was right on target. Don't think it's anything to dismiss that Iraq had contrary to their protestations to the United Nations, trucks for the purpose of producing biological weapons. They said they didn't have them. They got caught. Proof perfect that they had them. The only use for those trucks is to produce biological weapons.
So there you go, the official spokesman for the president saying that the president's very pleased by this. And in fact, as the Washington Post notes, on that same day, May 29, 2003, George W. Bush proclaimed a fresh victory for his administration. Two small trailers captured by U.S. troops turned out to be the long-sought mobile biological laboratories. George Bush said, quote, "We have found the weapons of mass destruction," end quote. Although, oddly, that audio clip, and I recall it, has just vanished from the White House website. You go to whitehouse.gov and you look for that press conference he had on the 29th of May, 2003. You can't find that audio anywhere. It's probably worth money. Anyhow, we have Ari Fleischer, though, in his own words. But here's the story behind the story. The Bush administration already knew, quoting the Washington Post, even as Bush spoke, U.S. intelligence officials possessed evidence that it was not true, it being what he was saying. The claim, repeated by top administration officials for months afterward, was hailed at the time as a vindication of the decision to go to war, but even as Bush spoke, U.S. intelligence officials possessed evidence that it was not true. A secret fact-finding mission, this Joby Warwick's article, the L.A. Times, Washington Post service, secret fact-finding mission to Iraq, not made public until now. We just learned this. Had already concluded that the trailers had nothing to do with biological weapons. Now, those of you who are longtime listeners to this program will recall 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago on this program, by the way, this month, our third anniversary of the program, we're starting our fourth year. Our third anniversary of the program, we're starting our fourth year this month. About 3 years ago, more or less, Scott Ritter was on this program, and he said, sure, there's trailers over there, and they have fur matters in them. And he said, I saw them when I was a weapons inspector. Of course they're there. He said, I can probably find photos of them for you if you want. I said, what are they for? He says, they're to make hydrogen gas, to fill up balloons. You send the balloons up into the air to find out which way the winds are blowing at 500, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 feet so that you can sight your artillery. It's for cannon sighting, for artillery sighting. And that's what they were. And as the Washington Post points out, leaders of the Pentagon-sponsored mission transmitted their unanimous findings to Washington in a field report on May 27, 2003, 2 days before the president's statement. The three-page field report and a 122-page final report 3 weeks later were stamped secret and shelved. Meanwhile, for nearly a year, administration and intelligence officials continued to publicly assert that the trailers were weapons facilities. One expert who studied the trailers, quote, there was no connection to anything biological, end quote. Interviews reveal that the technical team was unequivocal in its conclusion that the trailers were not intended to manufacture biological weapons. In June, now here we are a month after this report came back, Secretary of State Colin Powell declared that, quote, the confidence level is increasing that the trailers were intended for biowarfare. In September, what is that, 5 months after they knew that these things had nothing to do with biological facilities, that they were for making hydrogen to fill up balloons. Vice President Dick Cheney pronounced the trailers to be mobile biological facilities and said they could have been used to produce anthrax or smallpox. Amazing. The lies of the Bush administration, and now, you know, at the time we thought, geez, these guys are just incredibly incompetent. And now we're discovering, no, it's got nothing to do with incompetence. They are intentionally misleading us. They are conducting psychological operations against the United States of America. So a lot on the table. We've illegal immigration, the Bush presidency, Franklin Roosevelt's the anniversary of his death. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, thanks for calling the program.
Good morning, Tom. Congratulations on going into your fourth year.
Thank you.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've been saying this for years now that he sounds, you know, here's the usual thing. He's dumb. The president's dumb. No, he's very clever. And I totally agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more on this. It's mostly calculated.
Yeah. But no, and that's the tragedy of it. I mean, I wrote a piece for Common Dreams that went up yesterday, commondreams.org. You can see it, about how the Bush administration is using war for purely political purposes. And it's wrong. It's just plain old flat out wrong.
And I want to, it's terrific you're quoting one of my favorite presidents, one of America's greatest presidents, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You know, he, I think, was a classic example. We come nearest to the great, if you will, when we are great in humility.
Yeah, yeah.
I read this a while back. I'm not going to take credit for it, but it's always stuck with me, and I think he's a classic example of that. And this Bush administration, and rightly so, you pointed it out and brought it to my attention. I realized it, but I didn't realize it until you've been saying it. It started a long time ago, back in the 80s with Reagan, that government is an enemy. No, government is not our enemy. Franklin Delano Roosevelt proved that government had a role, had at least a minimum role to give us hope, it gave us Social Security, it gave us structure.
Yeah. And government in America, I mean, the great American experiment, this is the core of the great American experiment,
yeah,
is that government is us. In the United States of America, government is us. We, the people of the United States of America, do hereby ordain and establish this Constitution. And that's how it begins, the Constitution. Government is us in the United States of America. Thanks a lot for the call, Gary. Great to hear from you. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
I've been listening to the show for the past 3 years. I found you, I think, on White Rose Society.
Yeah, we were first nationally syndicated on Sirius Satellite Radio 3 years ago, well, as I said, this month.
I remember, like, IE America,
yep,
something like that.
IE America was the network that was carrying our program before we went with Independent and with Jones, and then now Air America is syndicating the program.
Well, yeah, the show is first class. And
thank you.
And let me tell you why it's my favorite. The format, I get so much news and information from you and your staff and the other callers compared to other shows who focus on just a few issues at a time. I mean, just the vast amount of information is just great.
Well, thank you for your kind words, Steve, but I suspect that you called for a reason.
Well, yes. Let me get to that real
okay.
quick. Just helping me win the water cooler wars, you know, this immigration issue. You know,
yeah.
I live here in Atlanta, and there's very few progressive stations, and one of them is a black station.
Uh-huh.
And I listen to it, and this immigration issue has got the blacks, you know, getting mad at the whites and the Mexicans and saying that the whites are mad at the blacks and everything. And, you know, I was able to get on the show and just say, look, you know, there's a war on labor going on. They want us to be divided, and that's exactly what you're doing. We need to focus on the employer. They're the ones who support illegal immigration. And, you know, the host was just like, you're exactly right. You know, and so thanks for helping me spread the word.
Oh,
now if
welcome.
We can just spread it to the Democratic Party.
Yeah, there you go. Next step. Thanks a lot, Steve. Good to hear from you. Alan in Arlington, Texas. Hey, Alan.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Alan? We have 1 minute here before we got to take a break.
Okay. Just specifically, I want to talk about this idea that the cost of a head of lettuce will go up if we pay a living wage to those workers.
Well, it will go up, but it won't go up so much that it's going to break the bank.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Did we not buy lettuce in the past? I mean, when immigrants made up one out of 200 people instead of one out of 30 like now, did the market not, a competitive market, not keep lettuce at an affordable price?
No, it was fine. In fact, what I understand, I had I also do a local show before I do this national show here in Portland, Oregon, and I had a guy on a week ago, and I think I might be mixing up my shows. This might have been on the national show, but I think he made the point that in this area, in the Pacific Northwest, wages for farm workers have not gone up in almost 15 years. And inflation has certainly gone up. So what's happened is that increasingly, progressively, more and more, the only people who will do the job are those who are desperate for those 15-year-old wages, basically.
Yeah, it's so, excess profits made on the backs of illegal immigrants.
That's right. It's the exploitation of immigrants and also the exploitation of the American middle class. I mean, everybody's getting screwed except the big corporations. They're making out like bandits. And it's wrong. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. For a change.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Come on. Baby, to come on up. Come on in. Oh, come inside, baby.
10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Now, let me get this straight. There was this Egyptian goddess named Ichthar, and she was a goddess of fertility. As I recall, she was Egyptian. It might have been Mithrasian or something like that. And she was a goddess of fertility, and so and the spring equinox is the time, you know, the first day of spring is the time when the goddess of fertility was always honored by animist and what today would be called pagan religions. And she was, you know, one of those goddesses, and so they honored her by symbols of fertility. They would eat eggs in the hope that it would make people more likely to become pregnant. People didn't understand back then, apparently, the details of how pregnancy worked. And they sacrificed the most fertile of the animals, the rabbits. They would cut them and sprinkle their blood on the fields as, you know, kill them and sprinkle their blood on the fields because rabbits are notorious for having lots and lots of babies. And so now Bill O'Reilly, and so we have the Ichthar bunny. Ichthar, the goddess Ichthar, you know, the resurrection of Jesus got absorbed into this springtime religion, and thus Easter. Easter comes from the word Ichthar, and the bunny and the eggs is all you know, it's old Ichthar stuff. And Bill O'Reilly now says there's a war on the Easter bunny. A war on the Easter bunny. Oh, man. I never knew Bill O'Reilly was a pagan. I didn't get it. Bob in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bob, what's up? Thanks for listening to Talk 1090 there.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. I really enjoy your program. Say, isn't this something I'm not hearing addressed on this illegal immigration? Isn't this further evidence of the failure to the American and Mexican people of the North American Free Trade Agreement?
It is in part. Part of the problem, though, Bob, is that you will find, and there are, quote, liberal or progressive critics of me, you know, of the pieces that I've written on this, who are speaking out. There's one over in Alternate right now, who suggests that it's entirely NAFTA. And if it was entirely NAFTA, then we wouldn't have had an illegal immigration problem before NAFTA, and 86 was the last time we did an amnesty.
So, but poverty rates, after NAFTA, I've read the whole, with Robert Rubin, Goldman Sachs,
sure.
Mickey Cantor, Bill Clinton, Bill Richardson, the whole crowd, Newt Gingrich, you know, I mean, it's a horror show of what happened with NAFTA.
Yep.
But my understanding is that, of course, Salinas and Vicente Fox, the big Irishman down there, the whole thing is really they're moving human labor just like NAFTA freed up capital. And, of course, Mickey Cantor, when he got the site agreements, and Bill Clinton betrayed not only organized labor but the environmental movement, and Cantor lied and said that he couldn't put that the environmental constraints and, of course, increasing labor into the general agreement, but put it on a site agreement, which was...
I got all that. I know the history of NAFTA. What's your point, Bob?
So anyhow, I don't hear that being honestly addressed, though, in the debate. I just don't hear it at all, Tom.
Yeah, well, I'm hearing it on the progressive side, and unfortunately what I'm hearing is people saying, oh, yes, there is a problem with illegal immigration now because of NAFTA, and if we do away with NAFTA, that's going to solve the problem. Yes, NAFTA increased poverty in Mexico. Yes, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. It also increased poverty in the United States.
That's correct.
And so, you know, to say that the illegal immigration problem we have in the United States is a result of NAFTA is wrong. The reason that we have an illegal immigration problem in the United States boils down to fundamentally two things. Number one, the destruction of the labor movement in the United States. When Reagan came into office, 25% of the workforce was unionized. The unions were the first bulwark against illegal immigrants because in a lot of shops you had to be a union member, and the unions were, you know, pretty picky. They would say, hey, if you're an illegal immigrant, you're not coming into this workplace. They knew that this is why Cesar Chavez marched against illegal immigration. And then secondly, we used to enforce laws that penalized employers.
That's
we no
right.
longer, you know, we now have unionization down to 7% of the private workforce as a result of 25 years of organized war on organized labor by Republicans, and I would say with the trade laws of the Clinton administration as well. And that's down, that barrier is down, and we're no longer finding employers.
But this, well, that's one thing about this UFW labor and this global recruiting company that gives a little bright spot on it. But I just what I find disingenuous here is that the elites, the corporate elites, do not want to admit to the American people that NAFTA was a failure.
No, you're absolutely right, Bob. You're absolutely right. And neither do the news media, who are part of the corporate elites. And it was a failure. It is a failure. It's a disaster. Chuck in Philadelphia, and thanks for calling. Hey, Chuck in Philadelphia, what's up? We got about a minute here before we got to wrap this hour of the program.
Oh, okay. I'll try to get it in. Okay, first thing for following the illegal immigration is to go after the employers. Each employer that's caught with an illegal immigrant gets $10,000 fine plus 10 years in jail, automatic. It's written the same way the drug laws are written. We confiscate everything you own because you got it illegally, and we auction it off.
Yeah, and in fact, you have been exploiting human beings, which arguably
right.
is even worse than selling pot.
Absolutely. And then the person that turns you in gets 25% as a finder's fee, even illegal aliens. So if you have somebody that's working as a nanny and they get threatened, well, if you don't keep quiet and still, then we're going to deport you. They can go turn you in and get 25% on what you own and go home.
Yeah. Hey, good suggestion, Chuck.
And then for these employers, they're always saying, well, hey, you know, we don't know we hired. And Social Security now sends out new cards to everybody. It's got
yeah, well, it's not even a card, Chuck. We live in the electronic, and good points, thank you. We live in an electronic age. It should be a no-brainer to be able to log on a Social Security website or call the Social Security Administration and say, I'm thinking of hiring somebody. Here's my federal employer ID number, and here's the Social Security number of the person I'm hiring. Here's the information they gave me. Is it accurate or not? And that couldn't be used for identity theft if it was you giving them the information rather than the other way around. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. David Bacon is with us. David is the associate editor of the Pacific News Service, pacificnews.org, the website. He's also a San Francisco-based journalist and photographer specializing in labor, immigration, and the impact of the global economy on workers, looking at it right on the ground. In fact, he's the author of a 10-year Impact of Free Trade in the U.S.-Mexican Border documentary, The Children of NAFTA, photo documentary on transnational communities, which will be coming out later this year as well. David, did I get all the details right on that?
You sure did, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Okay, great. And dbacon.igc.org, the website. Dbacon.
People can go to see the photographs and the articles I write.
Right, dbacon.igc.org. David, you've been on the ground and you're doing your documentation of what life is like for people who are engaging in what you refer to as cross-border human realities. First of all, what's the situation out there?
Well, I think that the free trade agreements that our government has signed and promoted are putting a lot of economic pressure on people in countries like Mexico and Central America, and that's the reason why people are coming here. This is a difficult decision for anybody to make, to just sort of like pull up roots and to come, especially because people have to leave their families mostly to do that. And so I think it just sort of speaks to the kind of difficult choices that people are having to make in order to come here. I think that's the main reality of it.
Now, granted, you know, real numbers are hard to come by, but the Pew Hispanic Center, I think, has done a pretty reasonable job surveying this stuff. And they suggest that pre-NAFTA, that is, you know, pre-what, 96, 97, I guess 97 would have been the implementation of NAFTA. Pre-NAFTA, we had illegal immigrants coming into this country by the millions. And post-NAFTA, I mean, it picked up post-NAFTA, certainly, but that this is a problem that we've had basically since Reagan started busting up unions and stopped enforcing penalties against employers for hiring illegal immigrants.
Well, actually, Reagan signed the law that imposed penalties on employer sanctions that supposedly made it...
As part of that amnesty in 86.
That's right, part of that law. The reality was that that law had its greatest impact on the workers who were already here. It didn't really prevent anybody from coming here or discourage them, but it did make workers more vulnerable once they were here, so that it was a lot easier for employers to threaten them and to suddenly start checking their documents when there was a union drive, for instance, or where unions were negotiating a contract. So that, I think, was the main effect of it, and that's why the AFL-CIO now calls for repealing that law.
Yeah, and this is why I think that the whole idea of a guest worker program or a return to anything that resembles the Bracero program is just plain old flat-out nuts, because once again it hands all the power to the employer and creates essentially even if it's over a short period of time, you know, 5-6 years, creates a slave worker class.
That's right. That's exactly true. And that's also why the AFL-CIO now says that because there are these proposals, especially in the Senate, for 400,000 workers a year, employers being able to bring those workers in the conditions you're talking about, the AFL-CIO says, look, if there's room in our economy for 400,000 people a year, then they should be able to come here as green card holders, which would allow them to exercise their labor rights, would make them equal to the people around them, and would essentially make them free, rather than these guest worker programs, which essentially tie their hands of workers behind their backs and make it very risky and difficult for them to exercise their rights.
Right, and this makes perfect sense. We're left then with three options, basically. Number one, starts going back to our original immigration laws and saying we're going to bring into the United States a little over a million immigrants a year from all around the world, with special emphasis on people who are literally refugees, political refugees, and but still about half of our total illegal immigration into the United States is Mexicans, people coming specifically from Mexico, and or number two. We're going to simply open the borders and we're going to grant an amnesty to everybody and we're going to stop enforcing our immigration laws. Or number three, this crazy proposal that seems to have died an appropriate death in the Senate of let's do something in between the two and, you know, have a continuous program of guest workers so that we can continuously, in my opinion, so we can continuously dilute the labor supply. Am I missing something here, David?
Well, I think that there is a proposal out there by Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee that would at least in part help to solve this problem. So the first thing it would do is it would give permanent resident status to the people who are already here so that they wouldn't have to be as vulnerable as they are now without documents. Secondly, it would allow people who are not here in countries like Mexico to apply for green cards, the normal way in which people immigrate, in which we want people to immigrate here, and it would, you know, make the number of green cards available correspond roughly to the actual number of people who are coming here. So instead of people coming here crossing the border in the middle of the desert, people could do this in a normal way. And the third thing it does is it protects the rights of immigrants when they're here so that employers can't threaten them. And the fourth thing that it does is it sets up job training and job creation programs in communities where there's a lot of unemployment, and it finances those programs with the fees that are paid by people who are legalizing themselves so that we don't have as much job competition between workers at the bottom of the workforce.
This proposal assumes that only a particular number of people from Mexico and South and Central America are going to decide to come in, and that people from all other countries in the world aren't going to say, hey, what about me too? It seems to me like utopian fantasy, David, I have to say. I mean, at what point do we say this is enough workers? I mean, isn't there a line that we should draw where we say the reason why countries have borders, or one of the main reasons why countries have borders, is to protect their standard of life, and that has to do with the relationship between the number of people in the workforce and the number of jobs that are available. And as long as the number of people in the workforce significantly exceeds the number of jobs that are available, the wages are always going to be in the floor. They're always going to be, as David Ricardo in 1813 said, they were at subsistence levels.
I think if we're worried about the number of people who are coming here, then one of the things that we could do, which I think we both would agree on, is that we should stop negotiating these free trade agreements and austerity programs through the World Bank and the IMF that essentially create the conditions of poverty in other countries that uproot people, because the decisions of that people make in order to come here are things are very difficult for people in their families.
But David, you know, that sounds nice, but, you know, half of the population of Mexico lives on less than $2 a day right now. Before NAFTA, roughly half the population of Mexico lived on $2 a day. Poverty has gone up in Mexico. But, poverty is a result of a corrupt system. You've got an oligarchy down there. You've got a corrupt former Coca-Cola executive running the country like a kingdom. And not to mention, the Catholic influence prohibiting birth control, population explosion, resources not being appropriately shared. I mean, there's a thousand problems that have to do with the internal politics of Mexico long before we get to the stupidity of NAFTA.
Well, Tom, I've interviewed many Mexican migrants, and I think many people have told me that if there were a way for people to survive as farmers in Mexico, that they would rather do that. Coming here is not an easy decision that people make, and if they had a way of surviving, that they would. And Mexico actually has a presidential candidate in the election in July who's proposing to actually raise rural incomes as being a way of keeping people on the land and reducing the pressure for migration. So if he were to win the presidency in Mexico, if the United States spent some of its money on rural credit and made that available to farmers in Mexico, and we stopped negotiating these free trade agreements to, for instance, reduce the price of corn so much that, you can't make a living growing it.
Yeah, well, that's not just the trade agreements. That's also our subsidy of the industry.
That's right. I don't think that there's one quick fix, Tom. I think that there are a number of different things that we need to do in order to resolve the problem. But I think that the basic criteria that I use, at least when I'm looking at these various proposals, is what makes it easier for workers to organize, what increases the rights that people have, what increases the and helps.
Well, my one question for you, David. We only have a few seconds left. How do we decide how many people to let in?
Well, I think that the main question is what the status is of the people who are coming here, Tom. We have a legal migration program already here, and, green cards, and that's a perfectly proper and normal way for people to come here, and we all accept that. So if that's made available for people who want to come here, then I think
But we issue about 1 million of those a year right now. Should we be issuing 2 million, 3 million, 5 million?
No, I think that we just need to make sure that it corresponds to the number of people who are coming here and gives people some rights when they're here.
I see.
That's the main thing.
David Bacon, dbacon.igc.org, dbacon.igc.org to check out his work. David, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's all good. It's all right. Lord, it's always a good thing when you're glad to be alive. Everything I need ain't too hard to find. Why don't waste my time complaining? Because I don't see how I could.
And welcome back, my friends. Helping you win the water cooler award. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com, the website, and Eco Wine, the organic wine company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE. And, boy, last night, Louise and I opened a bottle of wine from the organic wine company that I've got a. In fact, I'm going to ask Louise if she can IM me the name of that wine, because I just want to tell you about it. This stuff, there was a time in my life, long ago and far away, when I was in the corporate world and doing okay, and also had to do a lot of socializing and whatnot, and became quite the wine snob for a while. And as good as any, $200 bottle of French wine, $500 bottle. I had with the CEO of CompuServe once, we drank a $10,000 bottle of wine in 1945. And And this bottle of wine from the Organic Wine Company that we opened last night, we've never tried this particular one before, was as good as anything I've ever had. It was amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, hey, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. There's today a very interesting sort of event happened, and that is there's a bunch of, I would say, liberal to, you know, democratic to liberal lefty reporters that meet once a month for a breakfast, and today's guest was none other than Howard Dean.
Oh, great.
Governor Dean said a few things. One is he was asked about this whole issue of impeachment and censure, and he said that he does not believe that's the way to go unless there's essentially irrefutable evidence that the president did not tell the truth. But this is not a way to go at this point because it would not win us elections.
Right.
He was also, there's a story in the Post today that there was some trailers in Iraq and some thought they were used for WMDs. And there's a question of whether the president did not tell the truth or whether he was misled by his own staff. And what Howard Dean said about that is that essentially if the Post story is correct, his staff is either incompetent or he did not tell us the truth. In either case, that's very serious. He also talked about the sort of focus. Well, let me, before I talk about the focus of the Democratic Party, the voting machine issue he was asked about. Diebold or Diebold, depending on how you pronounce it, he said was very, very serious. He said that they were not reliable. They were easily hackable. They can't be verified. The only thing that they felt good about was the Optiscan machine. And he said machines are huge problems and should not be used. Then he was asked essentially about what he's doing with the Democratic Party. He said that they took in $18 million this quarter. It was way behind the Republicans, but it was still doing better, that he is going for diversity in all elections, that he insists on people being trained by the Democratic Party, often multiple trainings candidates, that staff has to sign up for 4 years, and that we will not even get near, which he said many times, winning 2008 or future elections unless we build the party from the ground up as a grassroots party. And he said that this has got to be a grassroots party, that he has tried to flatten his organization so there's not so much bureaucracy. And he said that there is a consensus in the party for Iraq. He said that they don't agree on everything, but if you look at most things, it is a consensus. He was then asked about Joe Lieberman, and he said whether if he runs as an independent, what will happen. He said, we will support the Democratic candidate. We cannot get involved in state elections. Our only goal in elections is to keep things as civil as possible within the Democratic Electoral Party.
Right. In other words, he's not going to criticize Joe Lieberman either.
Well, I mean, he just said currently he's running as a Democrat, and
right.
If he so therefore he can't, you know, he can't get into that.
Yeah.
And that's right. I mean, that really isn't his job.
And Joe Lieberman actually has taken some fairly good positions for a Democrat. It's just that his positions on the war and, well, several of his
right.
positions have been quite off the wall, frankly. But
he then said that, listen, we have a 6-point agenda. The Republicans are trying to say that we don't have any agenda. He said jobs are number one, health care legislation, fiscal management, which Mr. Bush has not done a great job at, Iraq policy issues, education, and retirement issues are the 6-point agenda of the Democratic Party. And he said you're going to hear it over and over and over and over again.
They need to figure out a way to package that. You know, they need to come up with a brand like Contract with America.
Because otherwise, you're right, it's going to go absolutely nowhere.
Right. A New Deal was a great brand. The Square Deal is what Teddy Roosevelt called it. Franklin Roosevelt called it the New Deal. I mean, Lyndon Johnson, the War on Poverty. The Great Society, actually, was Lyndon Johnson's large frame. We need a new large frame, you know? A new
right.
large frame. By the way, we just have a few seconds left. You have a new headquarters in New York. I just wanted to congratulate you on that. TalkRadioNews.com, your website. People can see what's going on, and it's you're going to be doing interviews and whatnot from there as well.
Yes, we're opening a New York bureau. You got it.
That's marvelous. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com and Talk Radio News Service. Thanks for being with us today, Ellen. 27 minutes past the hour on the Radio Support Group. Up by and for We the People.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down.
There you go, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception, the place where despair is not an option. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. By the way, that wine that was as good as any Lynch-Bagey or Chateau Lafite Rothschild or you name it, Latour. This is from the Organic Wine Company. It's an organic French wine. I have no idea how much this stuff costs because it was part of a box. We got 12 bottles. We got a case from them of mixed wines, and I don't have the receipt or anything. But this is the best wine I have had in 25 years. It's Maz, M-A-S, D-E, Janinay, J-A-N-I-N-Y. And it's a Syrah. That's the grape, S-Y-R-A-H. And it's 2002. And it tastes like an 81. What was the good year for Chateau Lafite Rothschild? Was it 81, 82? It's a spectacular wine. Anyway, enough of that. Just for those of you who are wine junkies out there. Darren and Felton, is it Delaware, Darren?
Yes, Dara? Yes. Oh, my goodness. Okay. I was listening to the reporter you had on.
Yeah.
And I live in a rural area, and we have a lot of Mexicans, legal and illegal, here, as well as Central Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Archer Daniels Midland and other big agribusiness types are dumping corn down there because of the NAFTA agreement. Well, what I was thinking was, you know,
well, in part, they're dumping corn down there, actually, because we're subsidizing the manufacture of the corn.
Yeah, well,
with our tax dollars.
Well, what I was thinking, though, was, you know, down in Brazil, they've gone to flex fuel and ethanol, basically.
Right, about half of all their cars are in Brazil.
And those cars that GM is talking about on their commercials are ones they're bringing up from Brazil. Why don't we use that corn to make ethanol here and start retooling our factories to do flex fuel?
Well, we're beginning to. And in fact, the rules that require that are coming in. And one of the weird things is the oil industry last week, this is one of those stories that was in my stack I never got to, but the oil industry last week put out talking points saying that the reason why the price of gas is going up is because of the requirement to put ethanol into gasoline. Now, it's total nonsense. Ethanol is still cheaper to produce and cheaper at retail than the cost of gasoline at retail right now. The reason why the price of gasoline is going to go up is because the oil companies have figured out. They've looked at Europe over the last 20 years, and they say, hey, people will pay $5 a gallon for gas. They're doing it right now in Europe. They've been doing it in Europe for 20 years.
In Germany for 3 years.
Yeah, I lived there for a year, I was in England just a few months ago. I've spent a couple of years in various European countries, and people spend $5, $6, $7 a gallon for gasoline, and you know their driving habits change somewhat, and the type of car they drive changes, but people are willing to do it. And so the oil companies are looking at this, going, huh, people will pay $5 a gallon for gasoline. Now, one of two things is going to happen. Either we're going to charge that $5 a gallon, or the government is going to figure this out and put $2 worth of tax on that gallon of gas, which is what they're doing in Europe, and use that money for things like a national health care program. We better get there first. And so the gas companies, the gasoline manufacturing companies, big oil companies in the United States who manufacture gasoline, are going to be just steadily driving the price of gasoline up, my prediction, until it hits $5 a gallon, more or less. And my guess is that that's probably going to take about 3 years.
Oh, you think it'll take that long?
Well,
they're greedy.
I don't think it'll take. I think that probably within a year, within 12 months, they'll hit $4 a gallon. I think that price point between 4 and 5, there's going to be a lot of screams, and they're going to have to back into it slowly, crisis by crisis, in order to prevent Congress from preempting them. You know, but yeah, that's my take on it.
Well,
Dara, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
I got to move along. Good to hear from you, Joe in Provo, Utah. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Education as always. Now, let me see if I got this right. You can tell me where I'm missing the point. We destroyed a democracy in Iran in 1953 illegally. We overthrew Allende illegally. We gave $2 billion dollars worth of weapons to the junta in El Salvador to use against their people illegally. We had an illegal war in Korea, Vietnam, and so forth. We slaughtered 5 million people in Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam with weapons of mass destruction. And we want to beat up on people that are trying to feed their families, that are going to extreme lengths, leaving their families and their homes to take care of their community, because we're dumping our corn and we have this unfair trade practice around the world subsidizing so that the Mexican farmer can't even sell their own corn in the domestic market. Now, tell me, am I missing something?
No, I think you've summarized it well, Joe.
Jeez, we are not the nice guys. You know, see, America's got to wake up and understand we are not nice. If you look at our foreign
policy... Well, actually, I think that we... As in you and I think we, the people of the United States, are the nice guys.
And
right around the world. But let me just finish the sentence, Joe. But the corporate interests that are driving this country and have, frankly, for a long, long time, in one way or another, you know, there's been ebbs and flows in their power. They were down during Roosevelt. They're up now, for example. The corporate powers that drive this country are not the nice guys.
I know. I got all that. But here's the point I'm getting at. Because, you know, I told you I'm running for a political office out of Utah. And I'm bringing it home to the people. I'm saying, wait a minute, if this is a country up for by the people, and you haven't read the Constitution, go read it, get familiar with it, and understand that whatever's done, you're a participant. It's like saying, well, fine, you know, 4 or 5 people get together in a room, they're going to go rob a bank, they send a couple of guys out, the other guys stay back in the room, and they arrest the guys, and they find out the other guys are back in the room. You're going to say, but those guys are innocent? I don't think so. See, to me, I think it's time for accountability to the American individual and say, I'm sorry. If you're supporting these policies and they're illegal, then you're illegal too. You know, we've got to get this down to the individual because that's what this country's supposed to be about.
Well, I am convinced, Joe, I really and truly believe this. This isn't a rhetorical point or anything. I am convinced that if the American people understood what our government has been doing and is doing even at this moment and why and how, if they understood, they would not tolerate it. The simple matter is that because our media has been co-opted by the same multinational corporations that brought us NAFTA and CAFTA and GATT and the WTO, people are being entertained to death. People just don't know what's going on in this country and outside of this country.
Yeah.
So,
well,
you know, I think that's the major bottom line, and I'm not willing to blame the American people for that. I think that we are the victims of it, not the perpetrators of it. And,
but at some point, we got to take accountability. I can't change somebody else. But I can change me.
Yeah,
you can
wake up somebody else, and that's what you need to be doing. And I congratulate you for running for public office and you know, plug your website here.
Well, thanks.
No, plug your website. What is it?
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Oh, you don't have one?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's Being Human Party, BEING humanparty.com. And,
right.
Tom, you know, we need to talk sometime because I'm building a coalition of candidates. It doesn't matter what party they're running for. There's a 5-point pledge that we're all taking. The bottom line, the 5th point on that pledge is promoting policies that ensure every human being's right to clean air, clean water, clean food, clothing, shelter, education, and health care. That's going to be poverty, not just in this nation, but eventually around the world.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're looking, there's good candidates in all parties. We've got to get past that.
Well said, Joe. BeingHumanParty.com. Thank you. Thank you very much. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. It's not at all unusual for us to hear important breaking news on your show and then not hear about it again anywhere else. And I can't find it. Nowhere is it.
I assume you're talking about the electronic voting machines in Italy.
Yes, it's right. If this cons had felt it in their purview to rig the election of a foreign country, is big news.
Let me put out the caveat that I put out when I reported this the day before yesterday on this program, and that is that I got this from a news source in Italy. There, you know, in Italian, I had to translate it using Google. It was sent to me by a friend in Europe who said, "Hey, this is going on." Who had a friend who was in Italy who said that they were a witness to this stuff. And so I said, great, send me that person's name and phone number. I'll put them on the air. Send me some corroboration. They sent me the website for this news article, and I shared it with you on the air. But here's the caveat. This might be a National Enquirer kind of thing. This might be completely off the wall. This might be a complete fabrication. I don't know. David and I have been scouring the internet, and I know quite a few of our listeners have, because I've gotten emails from people saying, I'm looking around for this stuff, I can't find it. You know, trying to find stuff about the Italian elections.
It's been laundered. It's been laundered. I've been looking on all the search engines myself, and they all give me the exact same stories and leave out the exact same stories. It's, If
well, here is one article. It's called "The Italian Reality Is No Longer Important: The Italian Elections" by Michael Leonardi, and it's at counterpunch.org, and then / Leonardi 04102006.html. I'm sure if you go to counterpunch.org and just and then do a Google search on that site of Italian elections, it'll come up. And it's an interesting overview piece on the Italian elections. I don't think, I'm looking through it right now, I don't think that it gets into the, yeah, see, this doesn't even this article doesn't document the electronic voting machines. I don't know, Dave. I just don't know.
What we do know is that there was a shift of some 8 million votes.
Yes, that's the big thing, is that the exit polls were showing at the end of the election that Berlusconi was behind by 5 to 8 points. And with an electorate of 54 million people, roughly 45 million people, an electorate that large, we're talking about, that would be what, 3 to 6 million people, something like that? I can't do math that fast. But millions and millions of people. And suddenly it became a 25,000 vote margin. And so I'm of the opinion, Dave, that Berlusconi rigged the election and he miscalculated by 25,000 votes.
Bungled his own botching, huh?
That's right. That's right. And now he's trying to get a recount to get it back, and he's going to get his friends in the mob involved. And, we're going to recount your machine here. The drama continues. Dave, always great to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Today, the anniversary of the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, arguably one of the greatest presidents in the history of the United States. Roosevelt, in a speech before the Teamsters in 1944, this was just months before he died, actually, September 23rd, 1944, or about 6 months before he died, talking about how this guy, Adolf Hitler, wrote this book, Mein Kampf, in which he said that there is a technique to lying to people. Don't ever go with the little lie. Always go with the big lie. And by the way, the Republicans are doing this now. They've adopted it. Keep in mind, this is from 1944.
The opposition in this year has already imported into this campaign a very interesting thing because it's fun.
Now, by the way, keep in mind, he's imported into this campaign. He's running for re-election in 1944. This is a campaign of 1944, and the Republicans are claiming that the Great Depression was caused by the Democrats, even though three consecutive administrations, Republican administrations, Cooling, Harding, and Hoover, and all the tax breaks and all the laissez-faire economics is what led to the Great Depression. The Republicans are trying to reinvent history and claim that, oh, it was because of the Democrats that we had the Great Depression. So that was one of their arguments during the campaign of 44. So Roosevelt continues.
They have imported the propaganda technique invented by the dictators abroad. Remember, a number of years ago, there was a book, Mein Kampf, written by Hitler himself. The technique was all set out in Hitler's book, and it was copied by the aggressors of Italy and Japan.
And it was also copied by the Republicans.
According to that technique, you should never use a small falsehood.
Never use a small falsehood.
Always a big one. For its very fantastic nature would make it more credible. If only you keep repeating it over and over and over again.
Now, the Teamsters thought this was pretty funny, but this was deadly serious stuff, and Roosevelt knew it, although he still couldn't resist making a joke about how the Republicans were doing this.
Well, let's take some simple illustrations that come to mind. For example, although I rubbed my eyes when I read it, we have been told that it was not a Republican depression. but a democratic depression from which this nation was saved in 1933. That this administration, this one, today...
He's talking about this administration being the Roosevelt administration. This is what the Republicans were charging.
Is responsible for all suffering and misery that the history books and the American people have always thought had been brought about during the 12 ill-fated years when the Republican Party was in power.
So, you know, again, he points out the Republicans are saying that Democrats are responsible for the Great Depression. Sorry, it's the Republican Great Depression. And then he goes on. Here's the joke.
There's an old and somewhat lugubrious adage which says, never speak of a rope in the house of a man who's been hanged.
Never speak of a rope in the house of a man who's been hanged.
In the same way, if I were a Republican leader speaking to a mixed audience, the last word in the whole dictionary that I would think of using is that word, depression.
Yes, Franklin Delano Roosevelt speaking before the Teamsters on September 23rd, 1944. City unknown, but an old speech. Dick in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, I've got just three quick points, and the last is the most important one. I wanted to question this notion that the government still represents the people's interest. The government in place in Washington, D.C. today, and in far too many states and governorships, I think they more often represent the corporate interests that funded their elections and the corporate media that supported them and denigrated their opponents who actually may have represented the people's interests.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with you, Dick. And what we need to do to fix that is we need to clean up our election system, our electoral system. We have a broken system in many regards.
Well, you know, and also the same corporate media, if they weren't supporting this Cheney administration and their lies about the war, they're excusing them as just incompetence instead of the deliberate, you know, intent to deceive that they we clearly know they were. And you know, progressives that aren't influenced by the established media have said this, you know, all along, but they've been attacked by not just conservatives, but also many liberals in the media, and even some of their pseudo, you know, progressive publications. But you know, the one point I wanted to make here is that if we don't start our own polling service with contextual relevant questions, nothing, you know, is going to change, because that's what drives our politicians, not petitions and demonstrations. It's the polling.
Yeah. So you think that the Democratic Party or progressives should be coming up with their own polling company?
They have to, or nothing will change, because that's what the politicians look at and listen to. And the polling that's being done now supports the establishment. They don't ask the right questions. They don't put them in proper context. When they do, they get completely different results.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree with you. Dick, thanks a lot for the call.
Good point.
Interesting. And a general speaking out on George W. Bush, General George Jolwan, has come out now on the Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer, talking about Rumsfeld's poor handling of Iraq. This makes, I believe, three generals who have now come out and called for the resignation of Don Rumsfeld. Incredible. I'll play the clip for you in the next hour. It's just amazing. Plus, we're going to be having Harry Taylor with us in the next hour, the guy who stood up and told George Bush last week that he should be ashamed of himself. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the real free speech zone. No barbed wire here.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here. The program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Harry Taylor, a real estate agent from Charlotte, North Carolina, stood up to George W. Bush on April 7th and said, "In my lifetime, I have never felt more ashamed of my leadership in Washington, and I would hope from time to time that you have the humility and grace to be ashamed of yourself." Harry Taylor, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Very pleased to have you with us. Sir, two immediate questions come to mind about your experience, and then I'd like to talk to you about your vision for America that may have driven you to that experience. The first is, you spent the better part of an hour in a room with George Bush, hearing him speak and watching him interact with other people. Is that, first of all, is my assumption correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, at relatively close quarters. And granted, he was on. You know, he was on stage. I mean, you know, I do public speaking. You're not quite the same person in front of an audience that you are in private. But my experience of public speaking is that it's also really impossible to ultimately hide your real personality. What's your sense of George W. Bush, having been in that room with him and, you know, and having actually talked with him?
I think he does a good job doing what he does. He spoke without notes. He spoke without a podium. He had an audience behind him and of course, in front of him, but he had two tiers of bleachers behind him. So he had people essentially on 360 degree sides, or every side of him. And he handled himself pretty well. He didn't often stumble. And he looks at people, and he makes jokes, and he's homey. So he tries to engage the audience. I was up in the balcony so far away I couldn't see his eyes. Mm. And I think there's always a telling sign of what people are, what's happening inside a person. But I think he's reasonably effective, and he's likable, or he would be likable if if he didn't do the kind of things he does. Mm-hmm. He didn't represent what he represents.
Now, there's Dr. Justin Frank, who is a professor of psychiatry and psychology at, as I recall it, George Washington University, wrote a book called Bush on the Couch, in which he set out to diagnose George W. Bush, and he makes the observation that it is very often actually easier to diagnose somebody in the public eye than it is to diagnose a patient sitting across the desk from you, because the patient sitting across the desk or in the other chair or whatever will more often than not, at least early on in a therapeutic relationship, be telling you what they think you want to hear rather than what's real.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody in the public eye, if you can look at the arc of their life and know enough details, you know far more about them than you know, in a normal therapeutic relationship, somebody would learn, you know, a therapist would learn in the course of certainly months, maybe even years. And his diagnosis of George W. Bush is of sociopathic personality disorder, that he is one of those, which is the category into which serial killers fall, that he's one of those persons who doesn't view other human beings as the same as himself, who views them as objects to be used for his own gratification, and notes that these people, like Ted Bundy, are usually very glib. They're relatively smart. In fact, sometimes they're brilliant. Their social skills are brilliant. I mean, Ted Bundy, everybody thought he was a wonderful guy. He was, you know, just, you know, so nice. He was working on a suicide hotline when they finally tracked him down after he murdered all those girls in Florida. Do you think that that's possible?
I couldn't say, Tom.
So you didn't get any sense of there's something wrong with this guy.
Well, I think he's been used for a long, long time, and he allows other people to use him to do things that that aren't favorable to humanity. And why that is, I don't know.
What if those other people are him himself?
Well, I don't know. I'm not that. I can't say. I would say that he probably. That he probably has an ability to be compassionate, but he probably picks where he's, you know, who he's compassionate to.
Right.
But I don't want to comment on that.
That's sure. Yeah. Well, I'm not asking you to play psychiatrist. I was just wondering. You know, it's not often that any of us get an opportunity to talk to somebody who has spent some time with George, but even in a public venue like this. So he's not the dummy that he's caricatured as in the media.
Well, he's not. He's closer to the guy you'd see in the YMCA locker room than he is some god someplace. He's a real ordinary person when he's up there talking like that, and I know that that's what draws a lot of people to him.
So what led you to stand up and speak out, Harry Taylor?
I'm really tired. I'm tired of leadership in our country, whether it's Democrat or Republican, and I know darn well that the leadership, and especially in Washington, is out of touch with us and doesn't seem to care much about it. They walk the halls with their lobbyists and their wealthy supporters, and the rest of us are cannon fodder. We're thrown to the wind. And he has irritated me since day one, and I was fearful that he would be as hard on the environment as he has been. He's been dismantling every environmental regulation he can get his hands on since day one, and his war just really, really frosts me. I am of Vietnam age. I did not serve in Vietnam. I was in the military, but I didn't spend time in Vietnam. But this one was really stupid, and I fear, I'm sorry?
This war.
Iraq.
This war.
Yeah, Iraq, yeah. And I deeply fear that we could, in an hour from now or 4 days from now, we're going to find out that he's bombing Iran, and I think they're setting us up for it right now.
Yeah, well, in fact, it's really rather startling when you read the Rumsfeld quotes, but, and I'll get to that a little later on, but there's a website, thankyouharrytaylor.org. 14,732 people have posted thank yous to you. Were you taken aback by the response, or for that matter, actually, probably a better question: what has been the response? From Harry Taylor's point of view, what's your experience been of having been the guy who stood up and spoke out to the President of the United States?
It's been overwhelming. I would have been happy to have a conversation like that with him over a beer in a local pub. Mm-hmm. But the only way, nobody gets to do that, and I did.
Right.
But I was just astonished at the reaction, and not just the reaction in this country, but the reaction all over the world and the reaction of the press. The response that I've been getting, that I've personally seen, has been overwhelmingly in favor of what I said, and even from people who said, I don't agree with what you said, but darn it, you have a right to do that, and we applaud your courage and tenacity and your ability to do it in a way that was respectful.
Now, have you received death threats, or is that just something that happens to folks like me, liberal talk show hosts?
I've received a couple things, but you could couch one as that.
But by and large, they're just cranks, right?
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope so, Tom.
We both do.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Harry Taylor, a real estate agent in North Carolina who stood up and spoke out to George W. Bush. Harry, are you going to take this any farther? Are you going anywhere with this thing? Are you going to run for public office?
I'm not interested in being a public servant, Tom, but I do feel like that there's an opportunity to be a catalyst towards change. And I've been working on trying to think this through. I am really passionately committed to how I feel inside about all this, and I don't see that just to let it die and walk away is something that I can live with. So I don't know what happens next, but for whatever reason, I seem to have some credibility around the country, and I would like
Maybe there's some way to take that 15 minutes of fame and turn it into a positive motion for change in the United States.
That sounds
marvelous. I'm assuming that you have gotten the mass email that's been going around comparing the photo of you with the Norman Rockwell painting.
Yeah.
It's almost spooky, I gotta say.
It is. That's another Harry Taylor out there, I guess.
Yeah,
disconnected
in
from me.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Yeah. Well, Harry Taylor, I have to say, I salute you for speaking out and thank you for showing up on behalf of all the rest of us. I think you did a marvelous thing. And if people want to get in touch with you, are you creating a website? Is there any way that you want people to reach out to you, or will that come down the road?
I guess it'll come down the road. I don't know, Tom, right now. So.
Okay. Well, great speaking with you, Harry Taylor, and thank you so much again.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. We'll be back.
bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
A day, 5 days a week, right here on the Tom Hartman radio program.
Now, the Delay Political Death Watch.
Yes, one side note to Tom Delay's resignation, comments Steve over the cover bag report. It didn't get much attention last week, the fact that Delay was poised to step down for quite a while, but had to pretend to keep interested in keeping his seat for financial reasons. An additional impetus for putting off the resignation for now, until now, was suggested by John Fury, a former aide to Tom Delay and House Speaker, and a former aide to House Speaker J. Dennis Hastert. Fury said, Delay needed to raise money for the defense fund. That was the bottom line. He wanted to make sure he could take care of himself in the court of law. This is the, apparently, according to his own aide, the only reason why Tom Delay actually ran for election in the primary was so he could raise money. And if you look at it, you look at the fundraising stats, he raised $194,000 from single-issue groups, $192,000 from finance and insurance groups, $119,000 from energy companies, $116,000 from healthcare companies, $107,000 from transportation companies, $91,000 from business retail. You know, the list goes on and on and on. And you add it all up, and he raised a total of $3,227,775. Of that, individual contributions from individuals, $1,935,224. And the amount left over after all of his disbursements, in other words, the total amount of money, he spent $2,701 on his primary campaign, on winning the primary. And then he stepped down. But he spent $2 million, but he had raised over $3 million. So what's left over now? What Tom Delay has in the bank that he didn't have before he ran for the primary is $1,295,350 that he can use to pay for his lawyers for his defense fund. Well, this has chafed a few people. He asked his contributors for financial support. Again, back to Steve's comment. He asked his contributors for financial support, telling them that he needed the money for his campaign, when in reality he knew he was going to resign and he wanted the donations for his legal defense. His con is legal but obviously dishonest, and therefore it's not terribly surprising that some of his donors want their money back. One lobbyist said, it's nauseating to think about his campaign contribution going to subsidize Delay's legal team. The lobbyist said, that's all this money will go to the legal defense fund. It sickens me. I have to pay for that? Apparently so. As Steve Bannon notes, as K Street lobbyists should know by now, you lay down with dogs, you catch fleas. Yeah. So there we are. Yesterday we had a guest on from the Cato Institute who was telling us that the solution to our problems, to the American labor problem, to the death of the American middle class, or the wounding, shall we say, of the American middle class, was education. And this note, I received this note from a fellow by the name of John. I will not give his last name out on the air. He says, Tom, I just heard your interview with a representative of the Cato Institute. Thank you for letting him not get away with anything. According to your guest, education is the answer for the American worker. Here's my response. I am 50 years old and have worked as a computer engineer since 1982. I have a computer science degree. I've chosen to have a family as an older father. I have a 7-year-old and twin 4-year-olds, and I'm working 12 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week, in order to provide an opportunity for my wife to stay home with the children while providing health insurance for our family. Every project I have worked on in the past 3 years involves supporting the moving of computer expertise out of the United States. I am currently working on a project for a large, well-known financial company based in Minneapolis. The company is coming to the end of a multi-year project to move all computer-related projects to India. My current responsibility is to train my replacements in India. The goal of this company is to lay off all of its employees, including middle management, by the end of 2006. This has been made clear when this will happen. The layoffs begin in January. The employees in India are very capable and are educated
themselves. They also work for $3 an hour. The majority of the employees losing their jobs are having a very difficult time finding new work. The top executives in the company, however, are each receiving millions of dollars in bonuses. I have been fortunate to remain employed so far, but in the next 2 years, I will be facing the inevitable situation of having to change careers in my 50s while trying to raise my family. Planning for retirement is the last thing in my mind. Survival is the first. The thing I do is very specialized. How do I compete with someone who will do the same work for $3 an hour? My education and experience no longer mean anything. The only thing that is important is that the difference between my current salary and that $3 an hour will go into the already rich CEO's pocket. Thank you, Tom, for all you do. Signed, John. John, your story is that of many people in America. It is the tragedy of America. It's the tragedy of the American middle class. And it is in large part due to the fact that our government is getting out of the way. Right? We are, you know, it all, as I point out over and over, it all started with Reagan.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
So we got the government out of the way in our trade policy. So it could just be corporation to corporation. Guess what? No more middle class. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a really great day to sock the nation, who just get in the way because their people have too much of a say. But boys, we have got the answer. Free trade. It sounds really good. It spells freedom for the corporate brotherhood. And you need us in your neighborhood with new global employers.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, the WTO. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change here on the True People's Radio. Oh, my goodness. I promised you General George Jowlwan. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. He was on Wolf Blitzer's Situation Room on April 11th, discussing Rumsfeld's poor handling of Iraq. Just a quick clip here.
What's the mentality? A 4-star general, a 3-star general, meets with the defense secretary. The defense secretary is hell-bent on doing what he wants to do. The generals or general disagrees. At what point do you stand up and say, Mr. Secretary, I have to resign?
Now, we're talking here about over Iraq.
You have hit the nail on the head. It's our responsibility as military leaders to stand up and be counted on tough issues. And if that's not done, if they cannot take the intimidation, the micromanagement by this Department of Defense, which there is, if they don't stand up and have the moral courage to stand up and defend their troops and the mission that they've been assigned, then it's their issue, their problem. And I would hope there'd be more of that. I've been saying that for a long time. This does not mean you don't support the troops or you don't support the war even, but it's the method, the tone. And I would hope the secretary would realize all of this.
Now, this is a very difficult situation. I mean, in some ways, it's almost a confusing situation because you have people who, in the military, who by training do what they're told. And you have a constitution which clearly places authority over the military in the hands of civilians. And this was very, very intentional on the part of the founders of this country. They did not want the military to have its own independent branch of power or authority. They wanted to be sure that it was answerable to somebody who was answerable to us, and that somebody had no interests that concurred with those of the military beyond the defense of this country. And that's why they made the president the commander-in-chief of the military. And the president then delegates his authority to do that to the Secretary of Defense. Secretary of Defense is then the boss of the military. So here we have a general saying, in effect, that the military should be saying, the officers in the military. Now, the point here, and we mentioned this in the program a few days ago, but it bears repeating, the point here being that enlisted men and women take an oath to both to the Constitution of the United States and to follow the orders of their superior officers. The officer corps does not take an oath to follow the orders of their superior officers. They take an oath to protect and defend not the president, not the Secretary of Defense, not to follow orders. They take an oath to protect and defend not even the United States, the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution of the United States is placed higher than the well-being of the country itself in the oaths of office. Now, you think about that for a minute. I mean, you say, whoa, wait a minute. Are you kidding? No, seriously, this is it. The Constitution of the United States, you know, very clearly lays it out. In fact, here, Article 2, Section 1, Paragraph 8 of the Constitution of the United States. This is the executive branch, right? This is about the president. Before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. This is what the president has to swear to. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Period. End of quote. End of sentence. End of paragraph. End of section. There's nothing in there about protecting Americans. There's nothing in there about defending Americans. It's about defending and protecting the Constitution. And the Constitution, by the way, says you can't put people in jail without trial, without rights of, you know, don't, but not to, you know, get off on a rant here about Jose Padilla. But the point is that the officer corps, just like the president in the military, take an oath to the Constitution. Now, this puts the officer corps in a terrible dilemma. What if the president is doing something that they believe violates the Constitution? And yet their job description is that they have to do what the president tells them. Their inclination by training is to do what they are ordered by their superiors, and the president is the ultimate superior. And yet their oath, what they swore to do, was protect and defend the Constitution. What should they do? And if they did, if the officer corps in the military did stand up to the president and say, no, I'm not going to do that, at that point they've committed insubordination. And if they take an action based on that, no, I'm not going to do that, they have committed, they have begun a coup d'etat. They've begun a military coup. This is why all these guys, all these officers who are now asking their fellow officers to stand up and speak out are asking them to first resign, so that they will not be in the position of advocating a coup by the military against the Bush administration. But it's, I mean, we're talking about very, very, very fine lines here. We have a military now that is so furious with and so upset with the Bush administration and upset about, you know, the Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney essentially breaking the military, that they are suggesting that officers within the officer corps should step back and resign and then speak out, knowing that they can't speak out before they resign. I mean, this is just breathtaking. And I don't mean that as good or bad. I mean just shocking. This is something that is unique in my experience. I think outside of the Civil War, to the best of my knowledge, there has never been a time in the United States when the senior command of the United States military has gone to the extraordinary step of in numbers. We're not talking about one. I'm sure, you know, you find one or two persons, you know, here or there, you know, Spanish-American War, whatever, World War One, Korean War, who said, you know, enough of this. Certainly Vietnam, you know, spoke out. But here now, this, you know, this is like echoing across the officer corps. This is truly spooky. Aaron in Tacoma, Washington. You're in the military?
Yes, Tom. I'm a military officer, and I agree exactly with everything you said, that officers have a high responsibility, and we have a responsibility to sacrifice, you know, our lives and our liberty to defend the Constitution and the people. And I did so, and I had serious doubts against the war, and I was opposed to the war, and I brought this up with my chain of command, and I asked them to be separated. Now, I'm still a junior officer. I'm not yet eligible to get just ask for a resignation or for relief. Mm-hmm. But I did so anyways. I explained why I wanted to leave, and I asked to resign my commission, and they said basically, no, you're either going to go to Iraq or you're going to be court-martialed.
Wow. Now, am I correct in my, you know, following this logical chain that if, as an officer, you do anything other than follow orders, that that would either be at the very least insubordination, which is punishable, or at the most, it could be considered an act of treason or the beginning of a military coup, essentially, if you were to conspire with others to do that? There really is, you know, it's either resign and speak out or stay in and keep your mouth shut. There's no middle ground, is there?
Right. Or face the consequences of court-martial and imprisonment, dishonorable right. discharge, and all the things that come along with that.
So given that that's how serious and draconian it is, it seems to me, as somebody who is, you know, looking at this from the outside in, and, you know, I was in the military, but I was not an officer, that there is... That this is a radical step for senior officers to be taking, to encourage other officers to resign their commissions so that they can speak out. Am I missing something here?
It is a radical step, and like I say, desperate times call for desperate measures. And like I said before, officers are held to a higher standard. You don't just say, you can't just use the excuse, well, I'm following orders, because you know where that gets you in some cases, like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo.
Yeah, and the Nuremberg trials.
Right, and like I said, you do have that. The Army, in a way, it's kind of a double standard, because they tell you, you got to follow orders, never question orders, do what you're told. But on the other hand, they teach you the values of personal responsibility and moral courage, and to do the hard right over the easy wrong, you know, sacrifice yourself for what you believe in, which is, you know, democracy and freedom.
Yeah, yeah. Aaron, in your opinion, as an officer in the United States military, is Iraq that big a deal that it's worth sacrificing your career over, apparently?
Yes, it is, because it's not just Iraq. What it comes down to is the Constitution, and this leadership that we have, this administration, has violated the Constitution and other international treaties and our domestic laws, violated them numerous times. And as officers, like I said, we have the responsibility to protect our country, and if we allow this to happen, if we be silent, then it's bound to happen again.
Yeah. Well, Aaron, thank you for your service to your country and your patriotism. I honor it. Thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. And thanks for listening to us there on Talk 1090 in Seattle. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, sobering stuff. On the True People's Radio. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's come through a hole in the air, from those ads in Tiananmen Square. It's come from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
And welcome back. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. By the way, that article by Michael Leonardi that I recommended, it's over at counterpunch.org. Michael Leonardi, a native of Toledo, Ohio, currently lives in Rome, Italy. Just one interesting sentence. The center-left is cockily confident of victory, always having led by around 5% in the polls, but digital voting machines are being used here in four regions. So, there you go. Again, it's not the Associated Press. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how this thing shakes out. What is freedom? Franklin Roosevelt died on this date in 1945. His thoughts.
That very word, freedom, in itself and of necessity suggests freedom from some restraining power. In 1776, we sought freedom from the tyranny of a political autocracy, from the 18th century royalists who held special privileges from the crown.
Okay, so we overthrew the king and the crown, but now have come new royalists, says Roosevelt.
But since that struggle, man's inventive genius released new forces in our land, forces which reordered the lives of our people. The age of machinery, of railroads, of steam and electricity, the telegraph and the radio, mass production, mass distribution, all of these combined to bring forward a new civilization, and with it a problem for those who sought to remain free.
A problem.
For out of this modern civilization, economic royalists carved new dynasties. New kingdoms were built upon concentration of control over material things. Through new uses of corporations and banks and securities, new machinery of industry and agriculture, of labor and capital, all undreamed of by the fathers, the whole structure of modern life was impressed into this royal service.
Sounds like he's talking about today, the new economic royalists of industry.
Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise.
There you go. This, by the way, from Franklin Roosevelt's 1936, July 1936, acceptance speech in Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention for his second term as president.
The royalists I have spoken of, the royalists of the economic order, have conceded that political freedom was the business of the government, but they have maintained that economic slavery was nobody's business.
You get it? And they're saying it again. They're saying, hey, you know, government should stay out of this. We'll do WTO, right? No problem.
They granted that the government could protect the citizen in his right to vote, but they denied that the government could do anything to protect the citizen in his right to work and his right to live.
And again, they're making those same denials. And what must we do?
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance. And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
Whoa, did I just hear a president of the United States saying that that our allegiance to democracy requires the overthrow of corporate power? Requires it?
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
Just like today, I might add.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny. For freedom, not subjection.
And here's the big point. This is what Roosevelt brought to the table. It's what Teddy Roosevelt based his whole campaign on. It's what Roosevelt brought to the table, is that democracy involves economics as well as everything else. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.